This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones, broadcasting from the beautiful hill country of Texas. And I hope you're having a blessed Memorial Day. I hope you're spending it with your family. Maybe you went and put flags outside your loved one's grave, something we used to do when I lived in Chicago. We would go to my great uncle who had a Purple Heart with seven oak leaf clusters, and we went to go to my grandfather's grave and we would put out flags. If you're near your loved ones, I hope you do that, or maybe you're volunteering with a local organization to put flags out at cemeteries in your community. If you did that, thank you. Mahalo, that is a wonderful thing to do. And I also hope you're barbecuing and you're spending it with your loved ones. Maybe you're listening to this podcast as you're fishing, floating down a river, drinking a Coors Light. You better not be drinking a Bud Light. All right, I hope you're doing that. And while we're doing these things, because this is why our veterans give their life. They give their lives so we can live free, beautiful lives with our families. So I hope that you're communicating to your children the meaning of Memorial Day. And so we have a special show for you today. I want to honor the men and women in uniform who gave their lives for this country, especially in Afghanistan, by interviewing Prince Wafa. Prince Wafa is the director of Afghanistan, VPP Afghanistan, and he's been key to our success and so many things on the ground across Afghanistan for the past 18 months since VPP had the privilege of participating in his evacuation and bringing him back home. He is a U.S. citizen, but he was born in Afghanistan and earned his citizenship through an SIV serving along U.S. Special Forces. We're going to interview Prince. Why today? Well, I want to honor our men and women in uniform who gave their lives in Afghanistan, not only for the freedom of America, but for the people of Afghanistan. And that's what makes us different. I want to honor them by bringing attention to the plight of their cohorts who have been abandoned, those SIVs, those Afghans who are promised in a contract that you will get your U.S. citizenship if you risk your life to serve along U.S. forces. Joe Biden, is no surprise to you, is a dishonorable human being and broke this very important promise. But the Vulnerable People Project is committed to keeping this promise and standing alongside our Afghan allies and their widows, orphans until they're safe. So I wanted to interview Prince. This man is exceptional. He earned his citizenship. And in a few short years, he went from living on the floor of his friend's apartment, came to this country with $2 in his pocket, to owning his own business, having a beautiful home. He snuck into Afghanistan after the fall to rescue his wife, a great risk to himself. He is the most heroic man I've ever met. Courageous, he's brilliant, he's hardworking. And so this Memorial Day, I'm doing a show that I think our veterans, our heroes, our fallen heroes would want. They would say, continue on with the promises that we gave our lives to keep. And VPP means to do that. This episode is being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project to stand in solidarity with the most vulnerable people in the world. When the world has left, go to thegreatcampaign.org and become a monthly donor. Give your best one-time gift. But if you really want to stand with us, become a monthly donor. That's thegreatcampaign.org. Also, this episode is being brought to you by the best newspaper in the world, Epoch Times. Go to iReadEpoch.com. Use the code Jason Jones, and you get your first month for a dollar. Now, check this out. Don't be one of those guys or gals that's going to a box store for the Memorial Day sheet pillow special. Don't do that. Especially don't go to Target. No. Go to mypillow.com, use the code Jones, and get great Memorial Day discounts on all the bedding you need. You're not going to box stores today, okay? You're fishing, you're barbecuing, you're floating down a river, you're jet skiing, you know, after you said your prayers, after you put the flags out, you're doing all that. After you talk to your kids, or what, you know, you're fishing, you're talking to your kids about the meaning of Memorial Day. But what you're not doing is you're not going to a box store. So go to MyPillow.com. The code is Jones. And with that, you're going to get deep discounts, better discounts for a great product made by a patriot in America. MyPillow.com. The code is Jones. On with my interview with an American hero, a son of Afghanistan. My brother is an American and a true American hero. Prince Wafa, our Memorial Day special. It's the Jason Jones Show. Prince Wafa, VPP Afghanistan Director, welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Jason, thank you so much for having me here today.
Brother, I've been wanting to have you on every week for, you know, we talk five times a day, every day. We're working all the time. And you're exactly. So busy with family and with your business and the important work you do for VPP. Like, it's hard to get you on the Jason Jones Show, and you work for the Vulnerable People Project.
Well, the thing is, all our missions are unexpected. Like, sometimes, you know, you don't know. You say, oh, I have time tomorrow morning, and then next thing something happens, and then we go disappear for like 2-3 days to just fix something that, you know, happening outside, you know, there on the VPP mission. But
it happens to me. I haven't done a show in 10 days because we've been so busy with Sudan and Afghanistan, and we get swept away. But the reason why I had to have you on today is Memorial Day. Today is the day that we as Americans remember those who fought and died for this country. It's not Veterans Day. Don't thank anyone. You can thank a veteran, but as a veteran, I think it's always very strange when someone thanks me. I'm like, I touch myself. I'm not a ghost. I'm right here. You know, this is the day we remember those who made the ultimate sacrifice. And, you know, Prince, yesterday I was racing to drop some dry cleaning off. Because I'm about to go on a 2-week trip somewhere around the world that I'll talk about when I return. But I needed my suits back from the cleaners, and so I wanted to drop them off before the holiday. And as I was walking in the cleaners, this really buff guy comes walking out, looks like a CrossFit athlete, and I notice he's wearing the same thing I have, which is an Army keychain. He's got this Army keychain. And then I looked and I noticed he was missing a leg. He had a prosthetic. And I looked at him and I said, thank you for your service, Afghanistan or Iraq? He said, Afghanistan. So just yesterday, as I'm walking out of the dry cleaner, I see a man who left a limb in Afghanistan. Our good friend Ryan Hendrickson, who we work with in Ukraine, had his leg blown off in Afghanistan and had 26 surgeries. And there were over 2,000 Americans, 2,402 Americans who lost their lives. And you served. And the reason why I wanted to have you on today, Prince, is because I believe the work that you and I are doing in Afghanistan is to honor the sacrifice of every American that served in Afghanistan and every Afghan that worked with us and trusted us, but most especially the 2,402 Americans who gave their lives to keep America safe and the hope of making a peaceful, prosperous Afghanistan. And then the wake of the Biden catastrophe, here we are. I wanted to have you on because you served along the United States forces. Can you tell us, Prince, who did you serve with when you served in Afghanistan?
So basically, I started with the 4th Infantry Division on the Herat province, and I was there for like a year and a half, and then I was transferred to a special operation basis, again in Herat, but we were stationed in Shindan. So basically what our job was, QRF, you know, like...
Tell people what a QRF is. Tell what a QRF is.
Quick Reaction Force. So basically our trucks were on 24 hours. If a unit were going out of a mission and something, anything could have happened to them, we were the only people to just jump in. I remember, you know, besides taking shower, then I had my uniform on like almost all the time, because you never know. Like, all I was like hearing bumping on my door, and it was like, hey, you know, like, we'll meet in there in 10 minutes, in 5 minutes, and whatever. We're just grabbing a backpack that I remember having, and you know, some muffins on it, some Pop-Tarts and MREs, and always ready to just grab it and pull it back and then run. So basically, yeah, and then the most recent mission that we had, we were closing down bases around Afghanistan and escorting the personnel to the safety to the bases from basically all over.
So how many?
And taking supplies for any units that they were not able to come because of an unstable situation on their area. So we were they were calling us bad boys. So to take them all the supplies that they needed to their bases because they were not able to leave.
So how many years did you serve with U.S. forces?
4.5 years.
How old were you when you started?
19.
When you
before 19, like 18 something.
18. Well, I beat you a little bit. I joined the Army on my 17th birthday. There's not many people who served legally. Now, but before you worked with U.S. forces, did you work with any NGOs or private military companies?
I was actually on the Afghanistan, like on a high school, and so I graduated high school basically in 11 years. So basically, I skipped a year. You know, we had an option to just, you know, you do like an we call advanced test, so you can skip a class and go higher, which I did with my 10th grade. But still, I was in the high school, and right after high school, I just joined. Like, there was no option for me to go anywhere, basically, directly there. At some point, I was interviewed to start working in the U.S. consulate in Herat. But because of some situation, some stuff happened that they were not able to get us trained, and they postponed the mission basically to start. And then I started with military, which I'm happy, a lot happier.
When you work
with military, is different.
Yeah, when you in your service with the U.S., did you lose any of your cohorts?
Actually, yeah. So we were. When we knew each other, it's like for units, when we're getting to a bigger base, everybody knew each other, you know, stuff. And yes, actually, I lost two friends on the mission, which they were shot directly in Helmand province. I had another friend on his very, very first mission. He stepped on an IED and blown up both legs. So he's still in Afghanistan, which is absolutely frustrating because he served. I know it's only a month, but he served and he lost two legs. But
wait a second,
he's not
so
qualified.
He is not qualified because he was. Are we helping this guy? Is he part of our list of folks we're helping?
We're in touch with him. Yes. Yeah, so he basically, I think, that in the couple of months because of the bad situation, he left to Iran, I believe, and I lost contact with him after that. So the problem was. So the way that SIV works is, like, if you're working...
So I want to explain this to everyone. So, by the way, the reason we're doing the show today is because VPP has launched an initiative called Project Noble Brother. Noble Brother is where we support Afghan allies who Biden, with the U.S., promised visas and have been abandoned in Afghanistan. We also support the widows and orphans of our Afghan allies who were killed in action and Afghan allies who were wounded in action. That's why we wanted to do... today's show. An SIV is somebody who has a special immigration visa because it was a part of a contract they made with the U.S. government to do the most dangerous job in Afghanistan, which was to be an interpreter. And these interpreters were the eyes and ears of these units. And so the Taliban would seek to target them because if you killed the interpreter, you blinded them and you made them deaf.
Yeah, that's what exactly they were calling us, eyes, American eyes.
And that's why they would want to poke out the American eye. So this man, because he was wounded on his first mission, didn't serve long enough to qualify for a visa.
Exactly.
That's absolutely horrific. I want to go back, though. The reason I want you on Two Princes is this new movie came out called Covenant. We can talk about that later, which is about an Afghan interpreter who saves an American's life. Then the American... feels heartbroken that his interpreter's abandoned there and being hunted by the Taliban, sneaks back into Afghanistan to rescue his interpreter. Why this movie was so striking to me is it was your story times two. You weren't an American interpreter. I believe you were in vehicles twice that hit IEDs.
So many more times.
Yeah, more than that.
I still have back pain from those days. Yeah. I remember getting blown up and fall off the bridge with the vehicle. All the personal name.
Yeah, you earned your citizenship. Something about you, Prince, and so many other immigrants, I say you're born American. There are a lot of Afghans who come here. They're Afghans and they're great Americans. They become citizens. But then there are others who are like, I think you were American at birth, even though you were born in Afghanistan. You're more American than Americans. Does that make sense to you? Like, exactly. You have that American spirit. You know, you bought your own business, came to this country with $2 in your pocket, and then 7 years later, you bought the place you first worked. That's the American. That's how Americans like to see ourselves. We're not like that so much anymore, but that's how immigrants are so many times. And here you were.
We call Americans.
Oh, go ahead.
South Korea. This is what we call American dream. And I don't know why people are complaining. I mean, we have problems, of course. But as far as the nation, as far as the country itself, it's great. You know, like we have, you know, the people are awesome. There's opportunity to work and get what you want to be. I know the politics sucks. It just, you know, like it's like every other country, it's basically. But our nation is great. There's so many great people out there, and then there's no place for someone to, you know, say, well, I cannot do this because of that. I cannot do this. There's always way to do things if you want to do it.
Yeah, in America, I always say you can be as anyone. I'm a high school dropout that was last in his class, right? I've published books. I've run political campaigns from the State House to the White House. Ended up having the privilege of going to university. In this country, you can be as wealthy as you want to be. You can have as much leisure as you want. You can balance that. It's your choice. And I think that's what's intimidating to a lot of people. It's convicting because you have to look around and say, at the end of the day, for most of us, now some of us because of physical illness, mental illness, whatever, but for most of us, we have to say that if I'm 40, 50 years old, I am responsible for my station in life, right? Now, when I got out of the Army, I chose to live in my car for 6 months to save money while I worked full-time and went to community college. And I was happy for it. I'm like, this is the best deal. I can shower at the school, sleep in my car, park behind the Home Depot where I'm working. But at the end of the day, we're as successful as you want to be. And here you are, you've lived in this country less than a decade, own your own business, drive a Tesla, have a beautiful home. But here's why the Covenant story is amazing. You served the U.S. as an interpreter and are actually also the guy that snuck back into Afghanistan to rescue his wife. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. That's when I was watching that movie, I was like, wow, man, this is... This is absolutely familiar.
Did I tell you about that, or did you go and not know when you went to see it? Did you not know that?
You called me like, hey, Prince, there's a movie. Just go watch it. It's called Covenant. I was like, okay. And then I actually drove like off the work. Like absolutely not a time for a movie, but it was like it's 1 p.m., which no one goes to the movie. It was like, that's the only time I have to go there. And I went there. It was absolutely a great movie. They did like so much good work to put things together. And Covenant is a very small piece of the reality of so many things are, you know, behind that can be really covered in one movie. There are like so many other stories there that unfortunately, if no one goes after that, they will get forgiven.
We're going to make sure. They don't forget. And that's one of the reasons things we're going to be promoting today as our Afghan Allied Voices website. What did you think when it hit you that it's about a guy that sneaks in because of a covenant? And you
I was like,
in.
Okay, well, so basically what similarity was this is this guy was contacting this colonel, right? Remember calling him like, hey, get the visa, whatever. And calling the State Department with the phone hours and hours. That was me. I was calling the State Department, asking for them like, hey, I earned my citizenship. I applied for my wife's visa. She is documentary qualified. I proved enough income that she will not be relying on any of the social help or whatever. I can afford to have her here. all I need is a visa that's reprinting on her passport and come home. And basically they were doing the same thing that did the guy, like, hey, we can answer those, there's administration process, there's this, there's that. But I was like, come on, we have so many people coming already without even asking them a question. You already have all the documents you need. You know who am I. Everything is proven that we are legit. There's no problem. And she's documentary qualified, means like everything is perfect. All they need to know is if that person on passport and paper are real and you're the one. That's how the interview works. And then stab the passport and go. But unfortunately, they were turning my phones down, like one on another. So that was when I had to make a decision to leave. And the coroner that was on the movie, I had a coroner with my friend Jared Wendell that contacted you through the EWTN, remember? I was contacting him to get me out, and he was the one making calls too. I was like, okay, that's very similar to my situation.
Well, your colonel, he sent me a message on LinkedIn, and it was classic. It was something like, I saw you on TV, I don't buy it. Something like, I don't believe a word of it, and I've reached out to everybody. Yeah. And nobody's helping us. And it was kind of, it made me, I'm like, I chuckled. He said, I have an American citizen who's stuck there with his wife who served for me. And I responded to him within seconds. And I think we were talking within an hour of me being on EWTN.
Exactly. Yeah. And then even after talking to you, I was like, I don't know, man. There are people calling sometimes, but they I don't know what's going to happen if they do anything or not. But, you know.
So even after you talked to me, you were kind of thinking I might be BS?
I was like, you know what? Because, you know, people, they were calling. Because right before this bombing happened, they called me. They got all my information. Like, everybody was like, oh, what's your information? Can you share your live location? This and that. I was doing all those, but nothing, basically. Nothing happened. They just wanted to fill up some papers and show, I guess. That's it. But nothing, no one really did.
Well, in fairness, Prince, in fairness, what I think they were doing, which we were doing as well, I just don't trust anybody. So what they were doing is they were building, we were told by the U.S. State Department to put together these Excel files and then get the Excel files to them. And so all of these organizations were building these Excel files. And honestly, Prince, this pushed me into despair. After this happened, it's embarrassing to say, because, you know, I'm in my house in Texas. It's not like I'm under any fear or anything, but after this happened, just thinking about it, it's about to make me break down in tears. After this happened, it was jarring. When the U.S. State Department gave the Excel files that me and my team put, and by my team, I mean at the time, was me and Armin Shakmakian working night and day, building these files. The U.S. State Department gave these files to the Taliban. They admitted it.
Yeah,
we did that. At which point, I had a breakdown. I thought, I just killed several hundred people. I felt that I was a co-conspirator in murder. By God's grace, you know, it didn't happen that way. But at the time, it was horrifying. But so all these groups were contacting you, and they were putting together, they were putting you, and they would change the databases every single day. They'd be like, okay, put their names in this link. This link belongs to this alphabet agency. They're going to help. And then, okay, this secure link is for this. And we just kept filling out database after database. But we were doing that at the same time, me not trusting anyone and not believing that anyone's going to do what they say, began working on overland routes out of the country through other methods and other, you know. So, I don't think they had ill intent. I just think they trusted the U.S. government too much.
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, like, I know they were taking their time, definitely, to calling and stuff. But the point was like, okay, well, I'm getting all those calls, but nothing really happened. So basically, back to the U.S. government, because they were the ones making the decision who should be on the plane or who not. And unfortunately, there were flights coming out of the country. I don't know who they were just putting into the flight, because they're like, oh, okay, we have your list. We'll get you in the flight. And then you just heard on the news, there was a flight leaving. And sometimes even some of, like, you know, like my family was like, well, you have American passport. Like, how like, who are these people on the plane? Do they really care about you? Like, I have no idea. I don't know. I mean,
but here you were a U.S. citizen while Biden tried to lie and say there are no U.S. citizens.
Exactly. So right a day before the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan completed, I called the State Department. There was a lady on the phone said, okay, we will not live until there's one American in that country. Well, like, okay, well, great. You know, like, your country promising you, right? The State Department is the point of contact for you as a citizen outside the country. And then next day, I was on my phone, lying on the bed, and I just saw Biden saying, all U.S. citizens on safety, mission accomplished. And I grabbed the phone, called the State Department, like, this is a big lie. I am in the heart of Kabul with my blue passport in my hand. If a blue passport makes someone American citizen, that's me, and I'm in the heart of Kabul. I was like, this is a lie, and I will definitely raise my voice to every American that they need to know what this administration did today. A couple hours after that, they reannounced saying, like, there is still around 18 or 20 American in the country that they're denied to come home. I was like, that's another weird.
Yeah, somebody on the Democrat side of the aisle in the State Department recently told me there are still thousands of Americans. Now, I don't know if I believe that. You know, I think maybe we would have bumped into them by this point. Maybe they were thousands of Americans that were left there and have been killed. But yeah. If they're still bouncing around, I don't know.
They could be even disappeared. Like, how do you know? You know, let's say if I'm an American citizen, right? Okay. In the country. Remember the time I was run out of my credit and there was no money for me and you just send me money in the country, right? If I wasn't finding you and my money, my phone was died, basically no credit, no money, and I was getting disconnected from anyone in this side of the world, anything could have happened to me without anyone knowing anything. I could be disappeared by now and no one even would remember, like, what's going on, what happened to them, you know? Oh, it's one is off. That's it. So what if something like that happened to them? I hope not, but this is a possibility.
Well, so many, you know, and the reason we're doing today's show again is it's Memorial Day, and this is to honor, I think, those 2,400 men and women in uniform who gave their lives to keep America safe and to serve alongside Afghans, would want us to honor America's commitment to the people of Afghanistan. That's why I'm doing today's show. How many, Prince, of people on our lists have just vanished? Where we communicate with them and then they're just gone. Especially early on. It was, for me, I was on the phone with a man while his son got shot in the stomach. I'm talking to him while his teenage boy shot in the stomach. Mm-hmm. And he had to make the decision. Do I leave my boy here? He'll die. Or do I take my wife and my six other children with us to the hospital and try to save my son's life? And of course, he said, I'm taking my son to the hospital. And they were in line at the airport. This was right around the Abbey Gate explosion. Maybe the day before, or day after, I forget. And we never heard from them again. That was the last we've heard of them.
I had this family. I mean, there was like a couple. So the guy had a green card and went like I did, go to, you know, save the wife and come home, bring her home, basically. They were on the suicide time, so they were on the gate and the wife got killed, basically. And he you know, she never made it to U.S. and the guy had to take the body back to the family, basically. That was very tragic. That was really bad at the time.
That's heartbreaking. Where was the wife killed?
On the Abbey Gate. When
oh, she was killed in the actual explosion.
In the actual explosion, yes.
Oh my gosh.
And they went back. I was like, they should have ever, you know, like, some people were like, why you were there? I mean, they made me go there, you know, because my wife visa took over almost 3 years or 2.5 years or something like that. 14 months only for just a visa interview. Like everything was done 14 months only for a visa interview. So basically, they were making so much more difficult to process it legally than just, you know, do it illegally, basically. At that time, I could have just get a visa to Mexico and then, you know, bring her over, basically. It was a lot easier. But unfortunately, that's how it was. And then the sad part is that people had to go that situation to save their families. Like, they had to go there. But, yeah. So you know
many other Afghans that actually went back and snuck into Afghanistan trying to rescue their family.
After I went there, basically when I was trying to go, I just told my business partner, like, I'm leaving, and I turned off my phone because there were like so many people calling me like, hey, don't go, don't do that. It's so dangerous. You're killing yourself. I'm like, I don't want to listen to any of this. There's two times you sacrifice, one for your country, one for your family, basically, right?
So there's an article for me to prove it. A Daily Wire that's coming out, I think, later today on your life, and I'll put it in the show notes when it comes out. But they talk about how marriage is the strongest covenant. That the movie The Covenant was about the covenant between warriors that serve together. But what is stronger than marriage? What bond is stronger than marriage? So of course, you're going to go in. What did you think was the likelihood of your success? Did you go there thinking, nah, I'm probably going to die? But maybe we can pull this off. Or were you like, were you like, no, I've got this.
I was like, well, I do my best. That's all you can do. Like so when you're in the military, you're going on a mission, right? Your hope or your goal is to mission to be successful, but at the same time, you're putting your life there. Like I'm putting my life. So it's like a business for me. Like I'm a businessman, right? I always do like a profit and loss. I'm like, okay. If I go there, we would get killed, or I can bring her home, and we'd be safe. So it's like 50-50 chance, right? Let's go. When I got to the border, basically crossing from the land to Afghanistan, at that time, the border was already under Taliban control. It was like very early days. So it means early days, there was no government, basically. There were just few people controlling that spot, few people controlling that spot, and all you had to, like, I mean, at that point, the person basically you're facing was the judge to make a decision about your life at the time. They were the soldiers to arrest you. Anything that one person would do at the time, like, there was no actual government to say, okay, arrest him, send him to the court. Let them make this. No. They were making decision on the spot, and that's it. And of course, if someone been fighting Americans for 20 years, what would be his decision if we see American in front of his face and he has the gun and you don't, and this is the best time to shoot, right? When I got too close to that, I was like, okay, my chance are like 80 to 20 or 90 to 10. Let's say this way. But like, do you want to go back? And I'll, I got this. I'm going in and see what happens next. So I hid my American passport under a backpack I had, and I just hope that they don't search me, because if they do search me, the American passport is a certificate. Like, you're done.
And this is what makes the policy of the Biden administration so abominable to me. We know as a matter of fact in Afghanistan that if you had a blue passport, if you were an American citizen, but you were also an Afghan, you got pulled out of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had blonde hair, blue eyes, you went to the front of the line. This is what the Biden administration did. If you're a troll from the left listening to the show, you're like, I cannot believe this is true. This is 100% true. Also, did it in Sudan, Prince. In Sudan, the same thing. If you had an American passport, but you were Sudanese, they left you behind. This is what left, what the Democrats get away with, to me, is unbelievable how they treat Americans.
So the reason they were doing, they were thinking, I don't know Biden. I think I was one of those, because one of those people told me, like, you're one of the most popular people on the State Department. Like, any desk we go, your name is there. My file went all the way to the, what's it called, security advisor office. of Biden. Like, this guy needs to get out. And he was like, it was like, I didn't expect, like, you know, like, that. I think that they were not expecting someone like Afghan can speak, or they will ever speak. Like, for example, if you go to Afghanistan and then something happens to you, your family here, or you will speak, and everybody will, you know, like, you're speaking to anyone without any problem. But what they were thinking, like, oh, if I don't bring this Afghan American, I mean, first of all, no one's going to interview him, or no one really care. No one will hear the voice. Let's get the ones that are making a lot of noises, basically. I think that was behind that. If not, then why wouldn't bring people? And then, because they're not really doing it for safety of people. If they were doing it for safety of the people, even American with blue eyes and what we were saying, it's the same thing.
Hey, Prince, if you and I were in Afghanistan together at the same time, I would be much safer than you.
Of course.
Correct. So,
of course,
I would say after you, my brother, you're getting on this plane. I will stay. Same thing in Sudan. You know, they weren't intentionally killing American citizens in Sudan. Both sides were trying to cater to us. But if you're Sudanese and an American, you're dead.
And then they were blaming them. Like, for example, they were blaming Afghan at the time. I remember, they have five family in Afghanistan and they don't want to live. They do want to leave if you let them take their family, my wife, basically, home. Like, that was my wife. There's a legal process that you can bring your wife or your husband, whatever. If you're an American citizen, you can, you know, marry someone outside. You can bring them. This is a legal path. I didn't even go there to bring my other part of them, like my brothers and stuff, which they should have let them in too. But I went for my wife after completing all the visa process. Still, they didn't want to do anything. They didn't even want to transfer her case to a different country so she can come over and they process the visa. Like, no, she had to stay in Afghanistan. That's exactly what they told me, and get processed with the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. At the time, U.S. Embassy was already closed. Like, what do you mean? You already know you're not going to process that. Why you want me to have her stay there while you're already closing the embassy? Like, what's the point? And if I wasn't going, I guarantee she will be still in Afghanistan. It's still in Afghanistan. But now I went there. I have an eight-month daughter. My life is established, but I know I put my life there.
I want to go back.
And I would.
Oh, go ahead, Prince. Sir.
Yes. And I was like, I would. Some people like asking me, like, oh, wow, what do you do again? I was like, I hope I never, ever witness something like that. But if something like this coming 100 more times, I will do 100 more times or 1,000 more times. And I don't, you know, I'm not regret of any moment from the beginning to the end of this. And I'm here now.
Well, and you know how rough it's been for the people in the wake of the collapse in the U.S. withdrawal.
Yeah.
Could you have ever, when you were serving along U.S. forces, could you have ever imagined it was going to come to an end like this? Is this how you saw it ending?
Never.
Or you could never imagine?
Never. Never. So here was the thing. Afghan soldiers were fighting. American soldiers were fighting. There was no way that Taliban could control anything unless there was a deal. So, hey, my old friends, here's the country. Back to you. No one would, even when they were fighting very close to the cities, I would never, ever thinking like, okay, they will take over Herat, which was my city. When they took Herat, then I was like, okay, I'm booking my ticket. Afghanistan is gone 100% because they took Herat. That city is absolutely different. You know, people are different. They're not even, like, if you're like, oh, Kandahar fall or Helmand fall, they were war for long, 20 years now. When they say Herat fall or Mazar-e-Sharif fall or any of the other northern cities, done. Afghanistan is done. You just keep making decisions. Never. No, it's still, if you're asking people, like, hey, do you believe that happened? They're like, there were no way that Taliban could ever control the country, except there was, like, just a deal, basically. Hey, you come take over. We are not fighting. We're leaving. Here's the key. Bye. And all the ammunition is yours.
I have a Green Beret buddy who resigned in August of 2021 from the military. Because in July of 2021, they were doing joint patrols with the Taliban. This is July.
Wow.
They were ordered to do joint patrols. The guys they were fighting, you know, 8 weeks before. And when Biden went on television, if you're a regular listener to this podcast, I bring this up a lot. In July 6th, I believe it was, of 2021, Biden went on TV and said, Afghanistan will never fall. You'll never see helicopters on the roof. 85% of the districts had already fallen. So the U.S. knew it was falling. So it's not only as if there was a deal, but as if they wanted it to end catastrophically. If they wanted to leave $88 billion in weapons to the Taliban, as if and somehow this was part of a broader deal. That, look, we'll leave you weapons. And again, like you said, so many people that came on those planes were not vetted. And this scares me very much.
Not at all. Like,
oh, go ahead.
Sorry. So basically, at one point, what the State Department called me, like, we were on call. I was like, hey, you know, like, there's, like, miles of people. And they go, hey, just, they were like, go go to the checkpoint of the Taliban and then get the pass. Like, how am I supposed to be getting a pass? He's like, well, show your passport and you're good to go. I was like, okay, well, how is that even possible? We were fighting these people for 20 years. They're my enemy. They're Americans' enemy. They killed so many Americans. They're behind the 9/11 attack and everything. How they became our best friends overnight? I'm like, and then they were like, well, we cannot guarantee your safety. I'm like, what's going on? You're telling me to go show my passport to my enemy that we were fighting for so long. And then in order to come home, and you also saying, I'm not guaranteeing your safety. Like, come on. Like, how what's going on there? And then the other hand, there are like so many people that have nothing to lose, basically. They're just like, airport is open, just jump on the plane, bring them to the U.S. And then they were asking them questions if they did, like, who are you or whatever. Which absolutely makes no sense, because you're supposed to be stopping people before getting to the plane. First, make sure they're legit to get to the plane. And the second, what if some of those Taliban just hide their weapons and just jumped on the plane and now they're living in U.S.? How do you know that?
You know, and we were so lucky that none of those planes blew up with all of those people in them. I mean, that was quite frightening.
Exactly.
It was quite frightening. And we know, I mean, Governor Salima Mazari has tried to get the FBI to return her calls. She was the first Hazara female governor in Afghanistan's history. And she saw known members of Haqqani and Al-Qaeda on the plane. And she went up and challenged them. Why are you going to America? You hate America. And she says, they said to her, we're going to spread jihad. She's like, I don't think America wants your jihad. But it seems like maybe we don't care, because the FBI has not even followed up with Governor Salima once. And I personally have reached out to the FBI several times and asked for someone to reach out to Governor Salima Mazari, who was BBC's top five women of the year in 2021. Time did a big spread on her. She's not a kook. She was a governor. She's very sharp. And it's as if we squandered, and it's the tip of the iceberg is the 2,400 men and women who died. Then there are the countless who are wounded, that have been wounded since I was in graduate school, Prince, in 2004. And that's a long time ago, It's 19 years ago. There was this beautiful blonde girl in the elevator. I was getting my master's in military science and operational studies at Hawaii Pacific University, and this beautiful young girl. I was older at the time. I think I was 20. No, I was 30. 31. So I'm older for a grad student. Beautiful blonde girl. And she's wearing an Army PT shirt. And I look at her shirt. I look at her. And my first thought is, she's a military dependent. She's somebody's wife. Or even daughter. She looked very young. And then I noticed she was missing an arm. I looked at her. She saw it, and I looked at her, and she just nodded. So there are all those who are wounded.
So many. Yep.
And my best friend was blown up in Afghanistan, Matt, who played a role in helping you. And but then there are those countless families that have fell apart that ended up in divorce, and the trauma of, you know, I have a friend who did 13 years of deployment since 9/11. He was away from his family for 13 years since 9/11. That's 13 years away from his wife and children. And this is very jarring. And what do we have to show for it? A country that's a failed state with 40%, 50% facing extreme hunger. And the U.S. mainstream media that whipped us into war frenzies twice is not even covering this. How does it feel for you to see the way the media is not focusing attention on the plight of Afghanistan?
It's just heartbreaking, let's say this way, in main thing. And I think in, no matter where you work, I believe, like, if you're military, you're a politician, you're on the media, at the end of the day, you're a human that should have a feeling about the, you know, your other, you know, people, the other people, but no matter where they are, like the same thing what we do, for example, helping others. Even if you're in the media, you know the reality. You should be showing that. You should be talking about that. Like, hey, this is wrong. You want me to show this while we have this bigger problem on the other side. So as soon as the problems happened, unfortunately, in Ukraine, you know, we all know the war happened. Basically, the media shifted from there, forgot totally Afghanistan on the ground. And some people, they like, oh, Afghanistan, oh, is this still issue going on? No, like, this issue started in 2021. It wasn't the end of it. It started. Taliban took over. The problem started there. Now, it's still going on. It's not like, oh, the problem ended on 2021. No. It started on August 15 when the Kabul fall, and so on. It's going on. We still have so many people on the ground. We still have so many people there, but no one wants to even talk about those anymore. Like, but they are human. They are the ones that serve Americans. And so many organizations that they were in touch and were saying, oh, we do this because the promise our nation made to Afghanistan, to our allies, we're helping them. But as soon as the media shift, they just left it, and now they are going to different sides on doing whatever. I'm like, okay, what happened to the feeling you had about the promise that nation made to Afghans allies or whatever? Why you forgot all those? What's going on with that? So they basically, you know, walked away from it. And I think we're the only organization that stayed, and we will stay there until we accomplish. You know, we've been accomplishing missions every day, which, you know, cannot really say a lot in here. But
well, even today, I just love my updates. And you're right, I can't share most of what we do with folks. We can share a lot, which is good, but we can't share. There's a lot of things we would wish to share, but we just can't. But like the pictures you sent me today really just make my heart leap. And yeah, you know, the reason I stayed Prince is twofold. One, I started to help one friend rescue her best, or one of her best friend's mother-in-laws. That was it. And that was the beginning of day one. And then by the end of day two, there were like seven people, you know, that contacted me. I kind of did something I was trained to do as a soldier, but once I said it, I had to stick to it. And what I said was, when people would call me, you don't know what to say. When people are like, I'm scared, there's gunfighting firing out of my house, they just shot my neighbor. You're hearing all these wild stories. And I would say what I was trained to say as a soldier, just came out. You're going to be okay. I'm going to be with you till you're safe. You know, we're told this when one of our comrades is shot. I'm sure you were taught this, Prince. As you're applying medical care, you tell them, the first thing you tell them is, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be with you. I'm here with you till you're safe. I said that to like 600 people. And then I realized, oh my gosh, I just made 600 promises. I don't know how I'm going to keep. And I'm not going to, so I'm going to be with these people till they're okay. By God's grace, of the almost, I think it was almost 700 people before I stopped making that promise, I realized I can't make a promise. I'm going to say nice. I'm going to tell them they're going to be okay, but I'm not going to tell them I'm going to be with you till you're safe, because I don't know what that means. But of the original list, we have 12 people left or so. that we need to resettle by God's grace. And we're not, and but beyond that, working with you, I realize how much work we can actually do in this country. You know, and that we have a promise beyond evacuating our Afghan allies. There's 180,000 SIVs still in Afghanistan. The Biden administration said they may let in 18,000 more. So that leaves the vast majority of people we've promised citizenship to, by the way, which is less than sneak across the border in 1 month, our southern border. That's, but what I've discovered is, you know, there's a lot we can do in Afghanistan. And when you choose to go to war with the country, you know what I look at it as, Prince? When you choose to go to war, when you're the powerful country and you choose a war, we're going to war. What you've decided is you're going to make babies together. And the babies are the catastrophe that you both left in your wake. And then the people that are suffering in the midst of that. Then that means we have a moral responsibility for what we created in Afghanistan. Period. I oppose regime change wars. I oppose nation building. But I am a big believer in taking responsibility for your actions. There are 40 million Afghans, 90 million are in hunger, 50 million are in severe hunger. And I think we have a responsibility to pay child support.
Exactly, yeah. Because none of them, like, it's like here, you send, you started a war, you sent a soldier to the country, the soldier got killed, now we have the babies here, and the wife here, and the entire family here, that you have a responsibility as a government to look after them. And the same thing in Afghanistan, basically. And not just the government,
like, hey, Prince. I think, you know, what's great about America is not just the government, but as a community. Like Texas, if you're a veteran, you're good, man. Everyone loves you. You're taken care of. People pay attention to you. I think we as the American veteran community and Americans, our government's out to lunch, but I think we have a responsibility to continue our relationship to work for what's best for Afghanistan, which at the end of the day is going to be best for us too, because chickens come home to roost. Can we go back to when you first make, when did you learn English? Did you start learning English in school as a kid?
So I was actually watching a lot of American movies while even before going back. Like when I was in high school and was trying to learn English, but like, you know what, I don't learn anything from this book. I still have to watch English movies. So I watched Prison Break maybe 10 times or 20 times from first to zero, basically. And it was very difficult for me, but every day I was watching one thing again and again and again and again. And that's how I catch up. And then I start working.
You learned English from watching Prison Break?
Prison Break and so many TV shows like that, movies like this. I had a thumb drive. I think it was like, at that time it was like gigabyte. I don't know, like 100 gigabyte. All American movies.
I only had Prison Break in Farsi, because I'm trying to learn Farsi now using the Pimsleur method.
They actually have it translated, but I wasn't watching it in Farsi. I was watching it English with subtitles. So the method was like, okay, watch it English with subtitles first time, and then take notes as much as you can. I'm sure you cannot take notes all of them, and just like some bold words. And then next time, watch it without subtitles after you're learning those words. And then the third time, you're basically understanding most of it, which is great. And sometimes you know what they are saying by their actions, because you already watched it 3-4 times. And that's how you get familiar. It's like a kid, you know. For the kid, we don't teach them grammars right away. We teach them how we start talking to them. They listen and they start talking. And then when they are in the 7 or 8 years old, then you send them to school to learn how to write and read, basically. But some schools are like, okay, I want to teach you how to read and write right away, which is impossible. Like, no, I cannot learn like that. I have to learn how to talk, understand, and then how to write after. Which I'm still learning to writing, though.
Well, your English is great. So when was the first time that you met an American? What year, how old were you when the invasion started?
Well, when the invasion started, like, you mean Afghanistan war.
Yeah, when the U.S. invasion started.
I was around like 8 years old, I believe, something like that. So I remember the bombing at night. We were running to the basement, which, so my parents had a bad experience from Russian war because they were bombing houses too. And we thought this is the same thing because there was no radio, nothing going on. And as soon as we were hearing a plane, like a, you know, fire jet or whatever, we were running to the basement, so down under the underground basement. So we were thinking if they bomb, at least next door, we will be safe. If they bomb the house, then we're done. But at least we were trying to get sick safety from that. We didn't know they're not shooting people. They're just bombing basically the bases, like a Taliban base at that time. So that's what it sort of was like. Yeah, I was, I went to school and then half of the school, the war started. And then I didn't go back to school basically until regime change.
And when was the first time you saw American troops after you heard the bombing?
I was 11 years old. Oh, sorry, I was in the 11th grade. I went to, so one of my cousins came from Farah province and told me like, hey, there is an American base in Herat. Can you take me there? So I do, because he already worked with the American forces in the Farah province, but his project was ended. And then he was like, can you show me where the base is so I can go and do a testing, an English test and Pashto test and Farsi test. That's what they were taking. So I can start working. And my plan was to go take him there and drop him off and come back. But he was like, no. Since you are here, why you're not testing yourself? I was like, come on, I don't speak English. You know, I don't speak Pashto that much too. Farsi is my native language, basically, or Dari. He was like, no, they're not going to hurt you or anything. Just go talk. There's an African-American getting the test.
Were you a little, he said they're not going to hurt you. Were you a little scared of Americans? Like, who are these people?
No, I was like, because it was a big line and you see Americans with those giant Humvees or MATVs from far away, you're not getting close to them because there's a big sign behind their vehicle, like, don't get close to us because, you know, because of the suicide zone, whatever they were doing that. And then now you're going to talk to them, like, there was like no chance for me to pass English test first, or also there was no chance for me to, my parents will allow me to work with the military. And I was still on 11th grade, so I still have a year of school basically to go on. But he was like, no, just go do a test and then that's it. You're just testing yourself and then go back. That will be an experience for you. So there were like lines of people, like so many. There, some people were coming with some certificates that I'm sure my entire high school homework wasn't that much. They had like that much certificate walking and they're getting filled and come back. So when it comes to me, they asked me a question. I remember one of them from the three questions. They was like, they told me there'll be a school opening tomorrow at north of Afghanistan. Can you translate this in Farsi? So I messed up the north and south, and I said instead of translating there will be a school opening on north of Afghanistan, I said there's a school opening on the south of Afghanistan. And they, okay, I'll go to the next question. So they asked me three questions. I was like, okay, go ahead. And I thought they told me go back. They said, no, you passed your first test. Now you have to go to the secondary test. I'm like, oh my God, I'm not even ready for that, basically. I didn't expect this, but I don't know, miracle happened, you know? I passed the first test. And then they sent me to the base. And there you have to do like 100 English questions test and so many Farsi and whatever. My plan was, because these people, like, not Americans, like Afghans, we were like five of us passed the first test from all those, like, I don't know, maybe 100 people, which was unbelievable for me because they were seeing some people with, I'm sure, better English. They didn't pass the test. I don't know what happened. So I passed. First one, basically, there's a conversation test, and then you go inside the base, and then you do your, like, actual grammar, you know, like, you know, translating test, basically, which was a lot more difficult than anything. And these Afghans, they passed with me saying, like, hey, if you're not ready to go to mission, okay, if you're passing the test, you get blacklisted if you don't go to mission. So you better failing the test if you're not ready to go. I was like, okay, I will make sure to fail. because I'm not ready.
And by go to mission, they mean go to war.
Exactly. Yes. And I'm like, come on, I'm 17, I believe, something like that, still. And my parents were like, I'm sure they will not allow me to do anything. So why I should pass? I mean, and I have like in my mind, I'm like, I got 1% of chance to pass at this anyway. Like, you're not passing. So as soon as they handed me the 100 question English test, which was they had the four answers, you know, the way that this thing here, I didn't even read one question. I just picked one answer for all, and then closed it in 5 minutes. This guy walked past to me like, it was easy? Like, yeah. I was like, yes. And then they announced it. So I got the best English score out of all the six without even reading any question.
This is God knowing that I needed you to help me with evacuations.
Exactly.
10 years later.
When I saw that, I was like, hold on a minute. Okay, now you tried to avoid it, but God's pushing you up front line. You're going to do this. Now I have two more tests. I was like, I'm going to pass this too. And I'm going, because in a book, which like a question chapters, which was like 100 questions with answers, like, you know, they have four answers. I did not even read one of them. I just circled question without, in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, done, give it back to them. And they said among all those six people or five people that we passed, I remember first test, two more failed the English test. Among the other couple, like three, four that was lifting there, I got the best score in English. I'm like, okay. There's a God plan behind this. That's what I thought at that point, at that moment. I was like, okay, there's someone's planning this way out of your control. So stick into that. And then I did my diary and passion test. I was like, I'm done. They said, you're done. Your testing is finished. You go do your... you know, they do the medical checkup and stuff. And I was like, okay, how am I supposed to talk to my parents in class? I still didn't graduate from school. So there's no chance for me to go there because I didn't graduate from school. I went back to home and I told my dad, I was like, hey, Dad, there's an American injury. I didn't tell him it's military because, you know, parents, but they've seen people getting killed. They don't want to lose someone, like, you know, their son. Okay, there's a civilian building bridges and this and that. Can I go work with him? Like, well, first they were like, no, you cannot. And then they convinced, you know, they were like, okay, well, you can go, but not now. You have to finish your school first. I'm not going to let you go there. So I called back to the number. I was like, listen, I have one year to be done with the, well, half year from this and another, something like another year or something like that for the 12th grade. I have to finish those. And then I will come back if needed. And they were like, man, there are so many people waitlisting to come to work and you're just getting the chance right away and you're not coming. So it's like, you're not getting a call from us anymore. Done. I was like, sorry. Okay. So basically went there, totally forgot. That was the first time I saw an American, totally forgot, you know, about everything. And I still was like, okay, I want to go there. I want to work with them. That was a dream for me to go work. So I saw this, you know, when I went to the base, it was like different world. People smiling at you. They're different than people talking about them outside. So graduated from high school. As soon as I graduated, seems like they had, I don't know, some point they put a note or something. They called me, hey, this is, at that time I was in France, you know, Nemat, yes, I guess. They were like, okay, do you want to work? I was like, oh, wow. Okay. I was like, yes, I do. So basically I went back, they assigned me to the border my first time. And then as soon as I went to the base, this sergeant, first class, that time sergeant, Dugan, I remember, he called me Prince, like, hey, we call you Prince, you look like Prince. I'm like, okay. I didn't know what's going on, like, what does it mean or anything. And I went to the base, they told me, oh, hey, this guy, hey, his name is Prince, he was our new interpreter. That's how I started, basically, the 4th Division Infantry, and they picked the name Prince for me, and here am I now.
What was your so you first met Americans then? What was your first thought about Americans when you met them?
So as soon as we walked to the base after, you know, for my test and then do the medical checkup, and I saw all this group of Americans, male and female, walking, waving, basically smiling, I was like, you know what? They're a lot different than people. There's propaganda about being like, hey, they're killing, and, you know, like how, you know, talking, you know, the Taliban, I'm sure they have influence of their media too, like propaganda about Americans. But when you go in, that's definitely different. It's like, okay, they're cool people. They're, you know, I really want to be a part of it. And there was this base called Camp Soon in Herat. That was awesome. That was it was a different world from outside. Like, basically, behind that wall, it would be different. And inside, it's, like, different. They have discipline. They have their smiley faces walking around. Yeah, they're definitely different. And then at the time I started, it was Ramadan, right? So some people are like, oh, they're not allowing you fasting and all those things. And then on Ramadan, there was a soldier, I forgot his name, a sergeant. He was bringing food for us for our breakfast. Like at 3 o'clock, he would wake up, go to the defak, chowal, we call it, like a place they pick the food. With this four-wheeler, we're bringing us food to make sure we have food to fasting tomorrow. Like that. Come on, this is that's absolutely amazing. You know, they don't, because, you know, the propaganda outside is different than when you really go in, and they're different. And they're like, okay, they're not only respecting, they're even taking, like, this guy waking up early at 3 a.m. to make sure we have food to eat. You know, this is absolutely different than what we hearing from the people outside.
Even though there was this propaganda to generate fear towards the Americans, was there a sense that the Americans were much better than the Russians, that there was a difference between the
a lot. So many. Yeah, definitely. Even my dad, because I wasn't at that time, at Russian time, I wasn't there, but my dad was saying, like, hey, Russians, they were different. They were, like, you know, shooting people. They were bombing houses. And almost every family in Afghanistan, if you ask them, they have someone that were killed or wounded or something. And then all those, like, ground mines that they were hiding in Afghanistan that is still taking casualties, remember? It's the same thing that the Taliban were doing, right? But the Russians were doing, like, a country. They were hiding mines so people go there. Like, so many kids lost their legs and so many people.
And the folks who are listening probably don't know, Prince, unless they serve the United States, we do not use landmines.
No.
If we put out a claymore or something like that, but it has to be controlled by a soldier and then removed.
We don't
just litter the planet Earth with landmines. And Russia is doing the same thing in Ukraine. And I would say the other exceptional difference is when the U.S. left Afghanistan in a similar fashion, although much more clumsy than in the Soviet withdrawal, I don't think the Russians thought twice about the people of Afghanistan once they left, whereas these American soldiers have been devastated.
I heard they even hate Afghans because they think, like, we killed their soldiers, because they send people to war, basically. They think we killed them. And that's why they hate Afghans somehow. That's what I heard. I never really encountered anything.
You were the pebble the Soviet Union stepped on and then turned to dust. So, exactly. But, you know, there is something exceptional about the American fighting man and woman. There's something exceptional. They're concerned for civilians. You cannot convince Americans to go to war in a country unless you first convince us it's good for that country. Other countries, you just have to convince them it's good for our country. But to convince Americans to go to war, you have to say, no, guys, trust us. Yeah, this is part of the war on terror, but it's going to be great for the people of Afghanistan. And we go, oh, I'm willing to die for the people of Afghanistan. I'm willing to take risks. I'm willing not to leave landmines. And then we see, I'm willing not to bomb from high altitudes. Now, our political leaders make other decisions. But go ahead, Prince, I'm sorry.
And that's the reason a lot of veterans they step in when withdrawal happened from Afghanistan. They were like, well, hold on. This is not what we were told. This is not what, you know, what happens to our sacrifices, what happens to our people that died for to establish the country. Now you're just handing it back to the Taliban. That's what made them to step in and basically start fighting. You know, like not fighting like military wise, just fighting back to bring people to safety and helping. And that's what we do right now. You do, you know. And I think that was part of it because they were surprised too. Like, what happened? We went there. We said we will help. And not only didn't help, but we give the Taliban lots of more power with all our weapons and stuff. And now we left them there.
And tragically, the Taliban can't even create a stable government. And so now the people of Afghanistan are suffering tremendously. Well, the Ranger Creed is, Prince, in the middle of the Ranger Creed, it's never shall I leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of the enemy. But not only did the Biden administration leave our comrades to fall into the hands of the enemy, they allowed their wives, their children, their parents, they allowed those who died serving alongside Americans, they allowed their widows and orphans to collapse into starvation. And I'm so grateful that we met because I think I've told this before. I had a way to get you out very early that was going to cost, I believe, $150,000.
And I remember that.
And you refused. And you and your wife had to stay another 90 days. You said, save that money. Don't use it on me. Let's find a cheaper way. And this was in September of 2021. It was the only way. It was very expensive. And you refused. And the day after you and your wife finally made it back to the United States, 90 days overnight. Yeah, 90 days. And that's a long, and that was a long 90 days. It seemed like 10 years to me. I remember feeling like we're never going to get Prince and his wife. We're never going to get Prince. It just seemed like it was taking forever and ever and ever. But those were a very dangerous 90 days.
It was, yeah. Well, actually, I was more than that. I was for 120 days in the country. Wow. And then it took me like a month or so to meet you, basically, and Matt. And then after that, we just got to those planes and came out.
Oh, by God's grace. And you have been helping us honor our veterans by serving our Afghan allies. And the people of Afghanistan, you and your family and your friends have been heroic. So, Prince, I don't want to take up your entire holiday weekend. And I'm about to do a little road trip with my family before I do this overseas trip, which I will talk about maybe while I'm there. Maybe. I don't want to make it any more dangerous than it's going to be. But I'll definitely talk about it when I get back. And but no, Prince, it is really – I didn't know that miracle story about how you kind of – tried to flunk the test and got the highest score.
That was it's funny. Any day I look back, there was something in my journey that absolutely gave me the confidence that God put me in that situation. He's the one managing, and now he's like, well, since you're a good manager, just manage everything. Okay, I just do my part. And you know, leave it on your hand.
That's in the Christian scripture in the New Testament. You know, you give a man a little bit, and if he's a good steward of a little bit, you give him more. You know, you give someone a little bit and they squander it, you don't give them more. And on that note, I want to end with this, Prince. Can you share with our audience, which, by the way, Prince, the audience of the Jason Jones Show is the number one source of support for our work in Afghanistan. And that's why I wish I could do the show every day. We're just so busy because I think if we did the show every day, we'd have all the money we need. We're constantly struggling for money, but we're also constantly struggling with bandwidth and energy because of the work we do. But can you share with everybody sort of as much as you can about what VPP has been able to do in Afghanistan in the past 18 months?
So basically, so many stuff. So I'm just sharing what we can share here. We've been delivering, still doing over 1. I would say now it reached to 1.6 million meals to Afghanistan, all over the country. Building three water well and system for the people that did not have clear water for generations. when some people don't even believe that they did not have water after all those money went to Afghanistan. That still there are people that did not have just the basic needs of their life, which is water, which is an essential one of them. And they were traveling with animals for 2-3 hours a day to get water. We were able to build well for them, plumbing to their basically village. So now they have to save their house and then go get it done, which saved their life. We were able to build canals for the people. We helped in very, far.
And those canals were helping villages that were flooding, repeatedly flooding.
Yes. Repeatedly flooding on the winter because there were no water out and all the water was getting in a flood and then go to the people's house. And then built female medical center, which absolutely saving lives. They had at least 3-4 casualty a year of females getting pregnant and not be able to get to the hospitals. But we built that for them. It's just right over there, saving lives every day. Well, there are so many of these keep even losing them. Schools, basically, we just, it was just one of them was just a few days ago. We went to one of the forest village in Afghanistan, and the people did not have classroom or anything. We basically helped them with notebook, backpack, and stuff. And I don't know what
our next mission is
built.
Chalkboards,
exactly.
Today, a young man who had a tumor that's just taking over his face and his head and pushing into his brain could kill him. He's getting a surgery today.
Yes.
Do the people of Afghanistan, do they know of the VPP?
They are getting familiar, actually. I'll have a surprise announcement. I'll do that after call. I have to call you for that. And people, like, basically calling from far away, like, they know VPP. They're the only people. They're like, you're the only people that we are hoping to get help from. Which, in one point, I wish country were never in that situation, that people, you know, constantly needing our help. But on the other hand, I'm proud to be a part of this, to helping those who need the help. So they really slowly getting, you know. We try to hide our missions in a big part because we're doing so many other stuff on the side too. But VPP is a familiar name now. Like anywhere they go, like people, they know VPP and some of them learn, thank you, VPP.
Yeah, it's
in English. Like, well, how can I say that in English? Like, thank you, VPP.
I don't know if I told you when I was in a taxi, Uber with my daughter about 2 months ago. We went to Chicago and then drove to Wisconsin. One of my best friends, actually the board president of Hero Inc. and VPP is a program of Hero. His wife passed away. She was one of my best friends, and she was my daughter's godmother. We went to visit her when she was in hospice. When we were in Chicago in an Uber driver said to me, I said to him, actually, I thought he was Hazara. He looked Hazara, and I just said, I said, Farsi Baladid. And he turned around. And he goes, I know who you are. Did I tell you about this?
No, I didn't hear that.
So I said, Farsi Baladid, and he turned around, and he smiled. He goes, I know who you were. I thought that was you. He goes, Mr. Jones, you rescued my wife. And wow. It was great for my daughter to see that, because especially my 13-year-old, sometimes I think my travel schedule annoys her. And how often, sure. How many hours I am in my office, she finds a bit frustrating. But it was just, I saw this huge, her eyes got really big and she got this like, what? And this big smile. And so it was so strange to be in an Uber in Chicago and then just bump into somebody that we had the privilege of helping reunite him with his wife.
Well, imagine if we were doing the stuff that some people do, like they rescued one and they now have shows and shows and shows about
book
that.
Deals.
So we'll be a lot. Exactly. But we're not doing this. We're doing that for God. We're doing that for our nation.
And you can tell, and you know, Prince, and you know, but you and I, we're always getting movie companies and others wanting to tell these stories. We're like, we still got work to do. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, they're the same groups. I'm going to tell you, Prince, the same groups that were coming in Afghanistan, rescuing people, making a big noise about themselves and raising money off of it, and then disappeared the day after the U.S. left. I bumped in them into Ukraine the first week. And now in Sudan, they reached out to me, which really kind of ticked me off. And I was getting proposals of millions of dollars. Like, we can rescue these many, you know, 20 people for $1 million. And, you know, VPP just with our partners on the ground evacuated 800 people for $60,000 or so. But it's the same groups.
They're there to make money.
They make so much noise about themselves. And we make as much noise as we have to make to raise the money we need to do our mission. If we had an endowment, it would be better never to tell anybody anything, really. You know, the best way to do what we're doing is to never tell anyone. But, of course, then we couldn't do anything. Prince, I just want to – you're graced from God. And I'm just so grateful my daughter and her husband live a block from you, which is just such a coincidence and a grace.
We're close. And I really appreciate having me in this. You know, you're doing great, huge project. It's sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, no matter how hard we work, and that's what I tell my wife sometimes, that when I turn around, when I sleep, I feel good about what I'm doing. And there's not many things you can do in the world that feels good about it. Like, be proud, like internally makes you relieve. This is what you do. And when sometimes I go through those pictures, the people we help, the smile face of those children receive our help on the front. I was in that situation one day in my life that, you know, when they were bringing me a notebook, I was happy for the 6 months or a year until I could totally forget about that. That, oh, I got notebook, I got pen, because we did not have anything. So now when I look at those pictures, it just puts me back to the situation. I internally makes me happy and sometimes crying to, you know, be able to do such a thing. God put me in that situation to help those people. And this is something that if anything in my life, the VPP missions are the stuff that I would definitely be proud of till the end of my life. And thank you for you to give me the opportunity. Thank you for thanks to all our donors who help us succeed this mission, which I call it Mission Impossible. There's stuff that it's really hard to do that. And then when you come up, God is the one putting a big role on saving or doing those things for us. And his power is the one that keeping us running alongside with our donors. There's some missions that I'm like, okay, I don't really know. God help me. And then you come up and it's already solved. It's done.
No, it's been unbelievable.
So I'm really grateful. Yeah, really grateful to be a part of this. VPP is a part of my life now. And after we show here, I'm driving back to my 7-Eleven trying to sell some Slurpee.
Yeah, by the way, you're doing all of this. We don't pay you. We pay you nothing. I have to like really demand you to always submit invoices. Don't pay for anything that we can't pay for. And you take it out of your personal account sometimes. And there were times we're on the phone with government. I'll never forget. We're on the phone with the U.S. State Department and you're like helping them. And, you know, we're working with them and we just hear you ringing up a customer in the back, like, you know, bink, bink, bink. And then someone from the State Department was like, what's that? And you're like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm running my business right now as well. And then the courage of your teams that you've recruited on the ground. I mean, there are a few stories that are bigger, they're more thrilling than the movie Argo or the movie The Covenant. You know, that what these guys pulled off and what courage it took and the suspense of it all. And by God's grace, I'm hoping all those kind of things are behind us now. And it's just sort of, Lord, please, we just want to keep everything smooth.
Yes, and I hope one day we come up with, you know, the one day we basically, all the problems, which it's something that it's a dream, I guess, be solved in Afghanistan. And we get together as a team. And then we basically should create a documentary for the next generation, what we have been doing, what God help us to do such a thing. And one and one and one, I think that will be a very great, very great, great movie for our next generation to see what it looks like to be in Afghanistan and being helpful from far away. Sometimes you don't know.
Yeah, when I'm with you, when we finish this, we'll tell the story, but not until we finish. And I can't wait to go to Herat. Like, I really want to go to Herat. Yep. Of anywhere in Afghanistan, that's right. I really most want to go. But Prince,
Herat is the place to go. Yeah.
I'm gonna let you go. I'm gonna land the plane. I'm gonna sell some newspapers and other things, brother. But I hope you have a blessed Memorial Day with your family.
Thank you, brother. Same to you. Safe travel. We'll definitely be in touch. Ongoing for sure. And I wish you success for anything you do for the people of Afghanistan and the world.
All right, thank you.
And
brother,
I thank all our donors who are helping us, who are keeping us, who I believe they're the hands of God to help us.
Praise God. Well, thank you, Prince Wafa, for everything.
Thank you. Right, thank you. Thank you. Have a good
day. All right, guys, that is Prince Wafa. Prince is the director of the VPP Afghan ground operations, everything from our support for education, for our support for healthcare, for food deliveries has been a big part of it all. And he's been a real blessing to our work. And if you count, we have two food operations, a Hazara operation and then Afghanistan General. It's a total of 3 million meals that have been delivered in the past 18 months. So why are we doing this all? Why are we doing the show today? It's Memorial Day. I want to, if I gave my life in Afghanistan, I would want the American people to pay me back. I would say, continue to serve the mission that I gave my life for, which is America's security and a peaceful, prosperous Afghanistan, which we said we were told was necessary for our security. Do you remember when we were promising the Afghans the world and we slushed around $2 trillion, that the right hand was putting money in the left hand? Do you remember that? And not even clean water, nothing was being done. We built a house of cards that collapsed, and less than an hour after the withdrawal of, it actually collapsed before the U.S. withdrawal. Complete collapse, 85% collapse, 6 weeks before we even left. So that's why I'm doing today's show. If you want to stand with the Vulnerable People Project as we serve the widows and orphans of our Afghan allies who were killed in action, those men who are the eyes and ears are for U.S. forces and then were killed, and now their wives, their children are starving to death, then go to thegreatcampaign.org and become a donor. We are committed to standing with our Afghan allies as we work to resettle them. We are also going to stand with our Afghan allies who will never have a hope at resettlement by serving our wounded in action in Afghanistan. Also, the widows and orphans of our KIA. All right, that's what I'm doing this Memorial Day, is I'm being thoughtful of the sacrifice of those who died in Iraq and those who died in Afghanistan and all of our other wars, that we should be a noble country. If only our government had the nobility of our enlisted men and women. That's all. I don't know about the officer corps. I think it's a mixed bag today, especially. It's very political. A bunch of ambitious political hacks, a lot of them, maybe not even most of them, but enough. But it's our enlisted men and women. They are the salt of the earth. We should get rid of the State Department. And, you know, whenever I go to Afghanistan, you go to Iraq, you meet the locals, they will tell you funny stories about Americans that always involve the U.S. State Department. And they're always absurd stories. And then they will tell you heartwarming stories about how they love America. And it always involves when they had direct contact with American men and women in uniform. That is our best public diplomacy, because they are America's best. And many of them have given their lives. 2,400 plus gave their lives in Afghanistan. And so let's honor them. It's thegreatcampaign.org. Become a monthly donor. When you're a monthly donor, that allows us to have the courage to say yes to every emergency that's put on our plate. As I said in the introduction, we just did a massive evacuation of Christians from Khartoum in Sudan, including some nuns that were in a very, very hard place to reach. And, we said yes to that. We said yes to that. And it was not cheap. We said yes before we had the money, and I went out to our donors, and faithfully they stood up and we were able to rescue almost 1,000 Christians from Khartoum. And our monthly donors are what make that happen. I'm babbling. By the way, this episode is also being brought to you by Epoch Times, the world's very, very best newspaper. You know that, and you're missing out because their Memorial Day edition is amazing. Go to Epoch, go to iReadEpoch.com, iReadEpoch.com, and use the code Jason Jones, and your first month is like a dollar, all right? Anyways, have a blessed Memorial Day for all of you, men, and all of you families that have lost loved ones. We're especially thinking of you and praying for you today. All right? Aloha. Jason Jones Show.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.